KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. So, in 1992, a movie came around that was basically sui generis. It was a black film noir, which may seem redundant except for the fact that there were so few black people in film noir. Blaxploitation films call themselves that, a few, but they really weren't. The film, of course, is Juice, celebrating its 25th anniversary, and the film's director and co-writer, Ernest Dickerson, is sitting across from me. Ernest, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's an honor to be here.
It's an honor to have you. And I guess one of the things I've always thought about the movie is that it feels like this kind of weird intersection to me between Man-Child and the Promised Land and City.
City Across the River. Which was, I think, was adapted from a book called The Amboy Dukes.
Absolutely. Irving Shulman's Amboy Dukes.
Yeah, I think it, you know, I think that story definitely was in the back of my mind. I saw it one time late at night on The Late Show back in New Jersey when I was a teenager. And Man-Child of the Promised Land is definitely a book that I always wanted to adapt to the motion picture. It was required reading when I was in high school. All young African-American guys in my high school had to read Man-Child of the Promised Land, had to read the autobiography of Malcolm X, had to read Wretched of the Earth by Franz Fanon. You know, these were the books we had to read when we were kids. So, but Man-Child was a book that I loved and actually read a couple of other times because I thought it was a great story, and it kind of just reminded me a little bit of my growing up. Man-Child is about young Claude Brown growing up and seeing the limitations of his world. But he was able to go on and write novels and become, you know, a pretty potent political and social commentator. So and part of that was writing the book about his growing up. So I still hope that one day maybe I can do it, but, you know, who knows?
Well, still begging to be done, but in the interim, you can tell people what Juice is about.
Well, Juice is about four young men who have grown up. They're 16, 17 years old. They're at that time in their lives where they're trying to figure out what are they going to do, you know. They have what's called a crew, which is just four guys. It's not a gang. A gang is a much more organized kind of a thing. These are just four guys that had common, you know, interests that just hung together. They're constantly harassed by a gang called Rapito Muerte on the street, and they want to figure out, well, how do we avoid that? And Q succumbs to peer pressure because they figure the best way to do it, to get juice or power or influence on the street, is to commit a crime. And Bishop is probably the most damaged member of the group because his father, we suggest, was brutalized in prison and has made him totally non-responsive. And Bishop fears something like that happening to him. And so it is the noir story about someone that allows themselves to be caught up in events that start spiraling out of control, a crime where not just one but two killings are involved. And what can he do to redeem himself? What can he do to pull himself out of that spiral of violence? And so it's the film noir thing of getting caught in a crime and trying to find redemption.
That's also a thing that is a part of certainly Man-Child in the Promised Land, which is this idea of black ambition with a glass ceiling is so low it might as well just be the floor rather than the ceiling.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that has always struck me about the story. There's all this kind of unchecked ambition. These guys are pushing against each other. They're getting old enough where they want to figure out who and what they are. For Q, it really is about, is he part of this crew anymore or is there something bigger on the horizon for him? And for Bishop, it's just about not wanting to be left alone at the same time, wanting to be bigger than the band of guys he's hanging out with.
Yeah, Bishop is he's at that point, he's trying to figure out where do I fit into this world. And unfortunately, he feels that the only way to gain any kind of control and power is through a crime, through criminal activity. And, you know, the environment has a lot to do with this. And unfortunately, when we were writing the script, you know, we saw how guns were becoming more and more prevalent among the youth, which was totally different than when I was growing up. You had a beef with somebody, you know, you duked it out and you got into a fist fight. And that was that. But, you know, guns, when I was growing up in the 50s and the 60s, that was like, ooh, a gun. No. Nobody's ever going to go that far.
No, a gun was what a criminal had.
Yeah. But for somebody to all of a sudden just pull out a gun and shoot somebody because somebody maybe stepped on their sneakers, possibly by accident, you know, that was becoming commonplace in the early 90s. And actually the early 80s, because that's when we wrote the script. We wrote the script in 81. So we started seeing that, and we were just, like, horrified by it. So we wanted to put that into the story.
Was this something you were always going to direct? When you and Gerard were working the story out, even in the early 80s, you thought, this is going to be a film I'm going to make as a director?
Yeah. It was, you know, I'd gotten out of film school and trying to figure out what am I going to do. And Gerard was a playwright. He had a play that was at Joe Papp's Public Theater. And we started writing Juice to possibly premiere ourselves as a writer-director team. And I figured I'd probably shoot it in 16 millimeter, you know, if I could get, you know, a couple of $100,000 and just shoot it raw and real on the street. And we did the script. You know, the characters actually came out of interviews that I did with my brother-in-law and some of his friends who were 16, 17-year-old at that time. You know, I got them together over at my mother-in-law's house, and we just spent hours just, like, talking, you know, drinking beer and eating some food and just talking about what their lives were like, you know, what the day-by-day stuff, you know, any interesting stories that happened, you know, things like that. And that was how it really kind of grew. And it's actually one of them that was having, at 17 years old, was having an affair with a 25-year-old divorcee. So I said, hey, oh, that's cool. I'll put that in there, too. So that's where these guys came from. And, you know, we took it around. I got an agent because I just shot my first film in 83, actually.
You say, for those, by the way, it's The Treatment. My guest is Ernest Dickerson, who many may know as an acclaimed cinematographer. He worked with Spike Lee on his first few films and has become an equally acclaimed director. His first film as a director was in 1992. That film was Juice. We're celebrating its 25th anniversary by talking about it and the spectacular home release of the film. But you were just saying you had done your first film, your first feature as a DP.
Yeah, and I had an agent and, you know, took the script to him, you know, to see if we could get interest in it. And basically, we were told, nah, man, nobody wants to see this. Forget about it.
Why would nobody want to see it?
We were told that nobody was interested in it. Nobody was interested in that subject matter. It was too dark. So it sat on the shelf for a lot of years. But what happened was that Gerard, my co-writer, he was getting another agent. She wanted to see samples of work. She wanted to see some screenplays. Most of his stuff was theatrical drama. She wanted to see some screenplays. And one of the ones that he gave her was Juice. She automatically said, whoa, why is this just sitting here? Why aren't you doing anything with this? This is, you know, this should be out there. And we said, well, we tried years ago. But everybody said, forget about it. There's no way nobody wants to make this movie. So she said, can I take it around? He said, yeah, sure. And next thing we knew, there were about three or four production companies that wanted to pick it up. And then we started getting notes saying, you know, maybe this would be better in a more comedic tone. It might be better if it was funnier. Maybe should we write it so it's more of a humorous coming of age story in Harlem. And Gerard and I were looking at each other and we just knew, oh, man, it's development hell bullshit. You know, we just felt that so many good scripts have probably gone through that development process where it was just the gonads were just cut off it. And so we said, thank you, but no thank you. We took the script back. And then one day I got a phone call from a gentleman named David Heyman who said that he got a copy of the script. He read the script and he wanted to talk to me about it. And it turned out that David and Neil Moritz and Peter Frankfurt were looking for the first film to produce.
And let people know what David Heyman has gone on to make since then. A little franchise called, what was that franchise called again?
I don't know. Something about a boy wizard who goes to a school for wizards or
oh,
something.
Oh, yeah, Lord of the Rings. Yeah, he's kind of David went on to make the Harry Potter films, among other things. But
and he also produced Gravity, you know, which was, you know, a pretty cool movie. So he's done pretty good for himself. But they were looking for something to do, and I met with him, and I told him, I you know, the production company that wanted to buy it, they wanted to get kids that were known on TV to play some of the roles. And I had always insisted, there's nobody we know of that can play these roles. We got to go after unknowns. That was always my plan. And I told them it had to be raw and real and shot on the streets, you know, not a studio film. And so he finally asked, he said, you want me to get funding for it? I said, oh, yeah. And David's father was partners with Chris Blackwell.
In Island Records.
Island Records. And their subsidiary was Island Pictures. So it was produced as an Island Pictures film, but ultimately it was a negative pickup for Paramount after we finished the movie. You know, once we got the funding, we started, you know, and it was a low budget film. It was $3 million, but it was enough to get the movie made.
And also, for those who don't know, it was the feature film acting debut of a young man named
Tupac Shakur.
Yes.
When he came in, he actually came in hanging out with a friend of his, Tretch, famous from Naughty by Nature. And we had really looked all over. You know, we had gone to my casting director, Jackie Brown Carmen, had gone to high schools of the performing arts, neighborhood theater groups, church theater groups, just trying to get all the unknowns in there. She went through hundreds of kids and narrowed it down. And I had a pretty good idea of who I wanted to be in what roles. But I was having a hard time finding a bishop, a real believable bishop. And Tretch came in and auditioned and did a pretty good job. And he's in the movie, not in one of the leads, but he's in the movie. But he had this guy hanging out with him, Tupac, who was there. And I'm getting desperate. And I say, hey, man, what about you? You want to audition? He said, yeah, sure. Why not? So he goes away. I first gave him a scene involving Quincy. And he went away, learned the lines, came in, did a pretty decent job. But something told me, have him try for Bishop.
What was that? Because you said something told you. What was it about him that made you think he would be a believable Bishop?
The thing that when he came back and he auditioned for Bishop, the thing that everybody else missed is the fact that all the braggadocio, everything that Bishop talks about, it all comes from pain. It comes from a deep pain. It comes from a deep pain and a deep fear. And nobody else had captured that. And Tupac did. He understood that character. He understood why somebody makes those kinds of choices, that it comes from fear and pain. And he put that in there. There was a vulnerability that he put into his audition that nobody else had captured.
The thing about Bishop is you have to see that he's the last person who should have a gun.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Q's fault, his downfall, is his inability to say no. His inability to go against the peer pressure. And that's one of the things that surprised us after the film came out, that so many people felt that it really addressed that part that is so much a part of growing up in anybody, black, white, Chinese, Hispanic, peer pressure. Peer pressure forces you to make decisions you don't want to do. And it's, you know, it's like that scene from The Godfather 3, you know, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. And Q was finding his voice, but he gets pulled into this crime. But Tupac, it was interesting because, you know, it became very, very obvious early on that he was a student of people. He really studied people. Sometimes we're on the street shooting and he would see somebody that just looked interesting. It looked like they were having problems in their lives, and he would go over and talk to them. And it was also interesting to note that while we were shooting in between setups, he would go over in a corner with a notebook and write stuff down. And part of me likes to think that, you know, what he was writing down became his music later on. So it was really, really, really interesting.
We'll take a break to learn more about avoiding the pitfalls of cinematic castration. My guest is director Ernest Dickerson, whose first film as director, celebrating his 25th anniversary this year, is the film Juice. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Get
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm talking to an old friend who I finally got to come by this rinky-dink little radio show of mine, Ernest Dickerson, who made his debut as a director 25 years ago this year with the film Juice, which is now on a great new home video box. One of the things, though, that you tend to move towards as a filmmaker, and it starts with Juice, is manhood. And the way guys define themselves. I mean, the films you've done, be the remake of The Most Dangerous Game or a cop buddy comedy drama, is about the and peer pressure is part of those things too.
Yeah, I mean, I was subjected to a lot of it growing up. I mean, you know, growing up in the projects in Newark, New Jersey, you know, when you're trying to find out who you are, you know, yeah, I had my friends that, or the guys I hung out with that I always felt I had to keep up with, you know, because I don't know. I guess I was kind of like an early nerd as a kid, but, you know, some of the guys I like to hang out with were more not nerds, you know, more kind of like, I don't want to say gangster, but, you know, a little bit harder than I was, you know. So, but I always had friends like that. You know, I guess growing up as an only child, I didn't have any brothers, you know, but I always had a lot of friends, you know, that we would hang out. We would just go leave the house at 9 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday and just be gone all day doing whatever, going to the park, going to different other housing projects, getting involved in all kinds of stuff. And that was one of the things I wanted to put in Juice. That's why.
That's actually the big thing in Juice. There's a lot of movement from one place to another in the movie, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. Always used to do that. Always just traveling just to see what was going on. What's happening over here? What's happening over there? Oh, let's go get some sodas over here, some popsicles over here. Okay, get them popsicles and keep on moving. And, you know, I wouldn't see my mother, or my mother wouldn't know at all what I was getting into unless I came home with a black eye, you know, which had happened, you know, just being on the bus and being with some guys that wanted to start a fight, you know, and get into a fight and get a black eye and come home. Where'd you get that black eye? Oh, Mom, I got into a fight, you know. It was just, that's why the parents in Juice have such a peripheral presence in the film, because that was my idea, just from the boy's point of view. When they leave home, it's a whole nother world, you know.
Sure. Well, I had to ask you a couple weeks ago for a screening of the 25th anniversary screening of the film here in Los Angeles, about the first thing you shot in the movie. That was a really interesting thing that you talked about. Tell that story.
Oh, the first day of shooting was, we were shooting the argument after they've, you know, from when they watch White Heat, and in that apartment. I think we wound up doing that because of rain. I remember it just rained a lot, and that did affect our schedule. But
it's a tough scene to shoot. It's a tough scene to start with, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, but, you know, the guys knew their work, you know. I mean, the great thing about such an extensive casting thing, casting sessions were...
And how long was the casting? Because you really use it as kind of a windowing away process of seeing who would work and who wouldn't.
Yeah, well, it took a couple of months to cast it, and then finally we narrowed it down to eight guys, because I wanted to find the four guys that together would create a fifth character, the group mind. And so I got it down to eight guys and did some mixing and matching. And actually, it was a little bit of a rehearsal for them, you know, gave them a chance to rehearse the material. They got a chance to really get more in tune with it.
It's also a way for you to test and see who would work. Yeah. Really, to sort of see how this dynamic would emerge from the right actors.
Yeah. But they knew the scenes pretty well. What was really wonderful was that Robert Townsend came through just to wish us luck. And I had
you shot his. You I worked shot, with him as a director when he shot the Eddie Murphy concert film, Eddie Murphy Raw.
Yeah, I shot Raw for him, and you know he's just a really good guy and good friend. So it was him and Laretha, a producer that he had been working with. So it was just nice, you know. They came through just to wish us good luck and you know just bestow their blessings on us.
But that first scene, again, because it seems like, and I've talked to so many directors who say, especially when you're shooting on a low budget, the first scene always ends up being a really hard scene that if you had your druthers, you wouldn't shoot on the first day.
Yeah. You know, if you have wiggle room in your schedule, you know, you can shift things around. For us, you know, a low budget film with a tight schedule, you know, a lot of things were into play. Okay, we can't shoot outside. What set is available? Okay, that one's not dressed. Okay, that apartment isn't locked down yet. Okay, we got this place. Okay, so we got to do that scene. There's so many things that come into play that affect what gets shot and when. And, you know, the actors come in, you just work with them and get them to the point where they're ready to go. And it was a good baptism.
It's a treat when we're talking about how to make a movie, how to make a first film with my friend who made his first film 25 years ago as a director. That film is Juice, and that friend is Ernest Dickerson, who directed and co-wrote. But I do want to get back a little bit to this idea of, certainly for Never Die Alone, I mean, the idea of pressure and masculinity. Mm. I mean, the way you have to define yourself, basically say you're a man, and sometimes it's the most juvenile version of what a man would be, but that's happened so often in your work.
I always try to find characters that are trying to find themselves, who they are, or have lost something about themselves and they're trying to find out who they are. In my next film, Surviving the Game, Ice-T played a homeless man who had lost his family, and he really kind of like lost the will to live, and he's given a job. He's given a job as a guide, an assistant guide, and for hunters who want to hunt, but later on he finds out it goes a lot deeper than that. But
that's what I was saying with the most dangerous game. But, you know, those guys who are hunting him are basically trying to prove that they're men. They, in some weird way, they could be like rich white versions of those kids from
well, you know, I wonder, you know, now that you bring it up, I wonder if it is just men. I like stories about people who are confronted with a situation where they have to find resources within themselves that they'd never even thought they had to try and resolve that. I think in my next film, Demon Knight, Jada Pinkett's character, who I wanted a young African-American woman for that role because, first of all, I wanted somebody that the audience would think was going to be one of the first persons to die. But she's somebody who had a little bit of a record, who had, you know, had gotten into some like really low-level crime. And now she's like, just when we meet her, she's scrubbing an oven in this sleazy hotel, but she ultimately saves the world. And I just love the idea, male or female, you know, people who maybe come from nowhere, who maybe don't know if they can ever affect anything in their lives, and they find out that they had the power to do something that goes way beyond that. So I think if it's masculinity or femininity, because even one of the scripts that I'm writing now is a female lead who has to go through the same thing, who loses almost everything, and she has to find those resources inside herself to pull up and fight it. So I love that story of ordinary people, you know, dealing with extraordinary circumstances.
I guess I wonder for you, because I've known you for a while and we've talked about so many of these things, but you came through so many other disciplines to get to film. You studied architecture and then you were a medical photographer and so many other things that do enough things that could have been careers mm-hmm. that you could have done well at, but they weren't what you wanted.
Mm-mm. No. Yeah, forces got in the way sometimes.
More like you push forces out of the way, because these are things that could have made you the kind of thing that I'm sure your mom would have loved, a solid middle-class citizen and a contributing member of society, but they weren't for you. And they were even artistic pursuits. It wasn't like you were going to be doing something that was so far afield from the creative aspect.
No, my mother always used to tell me, I wish you'd have gone to medical school. She wanted me to take the easy way out, you know. And then when I finally started doing pretty well in the film business, she said, I'm so glad I pushed you into the film business, you know. You know, it took me a while to find myself. Architecture was something that looked like the right thing to do. I was doing a lot of drawing. I loved.
But there's even architectural structure to your movies. I mean, you sort of like wander through, and the second act always feels like the biggest room in the house, whether people want to be there or not. But that's something, if you look at them, that's part of it, of all these films that you made.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, the thing that I got from architecture, I think, you know, is, you know, it was all about problem solving. It was about pre-visualizing the solution to a problem and then, you know, going through the steps to get to what you have pre-visualized.
And often having incredibly limited resources in terms of the kind of plan you have to put together.
Yeah. You know, how do you marshal those resources? You know, if you don't have enough, you know, how do you make do with what you've got? And sometimes it's your limitations that make you produce the best results because you just got to think harder. You don't have money to throw at it. You just got to figure the best way through it. And it's the same way with making a film. But architecture, then photography in it. And I got that job at the medical school, Howard Medical School, doing medical photography.
But also, too, the idea of photos and shots telling a story as much as anything else. I mean, this thing back to double play where there are some shots that we don't hear dialogue in for a minute or so because you're using that visual to tell a story as much as anything else.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that's the best thing about motion pictures.
I even think the riot sequence in Do the Right Thing, which there's a kind of a Tower of Babel of dialogue, but you're using that frame to tell the story.
That was like one of the great things about working with Spike is that we've been together for so long, he just trusted me with going beyond what the normal duties of a cinematographer would be.
That even goes back to the first film you guys did together where he's in front of the camera, so you've got to take on some of those duties too.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the way, you want to take a look at a very young Ernest Dickerson, take a look at the beginning of Do the Right Thing. He's right. He's one of the dogs. Yeah. To end, though, I mean, one of the things I've never really got to talk to you about is the fact that you're shooting Juice. You've got a black DP who is one of your camera operators who you worked with, Larry Banks.
Larry Banks was my gaffer. He was my gaffer on School Days, yeah.
And then you've got a black editor. I mean, that must have in some ways felt like this is what you wanted. You got the chance to make this film that you've been dying to make that really was one of the first things you ever tried to write with a crew that's some of the biggest creative contributors to your process are African-American as well.
It was cool until we got into the studio politics business because after, you know, the story of how I had to change my ending because they test screened the ending for the audiences. And if you get the new DVD Blu-ray set, you'll see my original ending because it's different than the ending that's in the film that everybody has seen. But the studio said that the audience did not like the fact that the character of Bishop ultimately decided his own fate. And people don't like to see that, where the quote-unquote bad guy gets to decide his own fate. And that's the way we shot it, but I had to do some editorial tricks to change it. But I think what we originally did was much more powerful and is much more haunting. So the original ending has changed. It's in there. It's not incorporated into the film. It's still in its work print stage with time coding on it. But people can see what the original intent was. I hope maybe one day I can go in and recut the ending.
Well, maybe for the 30th anniversary of Juice, you'll come back for that as well. It's a pleasure to finally get you here. Thank you so much for
joining us. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
My guest is my friend, I'm proud to say, Ernest R. Dickerson. His first film as director was Juice 25 years ago. A recording engineer here at NPR West. We did the whole show, no pass off this time. Patrick Murray, thank you, Patrick. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Pite, who's associate producer. I have no juice. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.